Hello?
Podcast of verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Allman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
Welcome to the coming apocalypse.
From the packed Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network, located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington, this is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here's your host, the submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons con, you have permission to fire.
Have permission to fire, con, weapons on.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today, most of them far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, history, the future, Mentos, volcanism, the law, and humanity. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. 73 years ago, Alfred Jodl signed the unconditional surrender documents ending World War II in Europe. There was great relief, but all those years later, there's still things that we could be learning. It's a pack of Mentos, really worth threatening a man's life over. Is there anything in the Constitution that would imply or even state outright that the government thinks that a man is stealing a package of Mentos, $1.99, then his life should be in danger? Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE, 565-3283. Email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and your favorite non-denominational web search engine, Eloqui Cunitio. The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Yeah, I'm here. I'm alive. All I'm going to say for it at this point, last night was just hell. I mean, I thought we, you know, on Friday, I thought we were past the worst of this, but turns out I thought Saturday night was the worst of it. And then last night was the worst of it. So I don't know. I'm hopped up on antihistamines and daytime cold medicines right now. So, and I've got, you know, coffee, of course. So hopefully I can hold it together for an hour. And if I can't, well, we'll just have to cut out a little bit early. I apologize for that, but it's I'm hoping that that this works. If it does, great. If it doesn't, well, we'll nuke it out somewhere or another. The wine fellows will have to come in a little bit early, and Tim will be here at noon, so we'll go that route and we'll get through it. My voice obviously is very rough, and I'm probably breathing like I'm, you know, inside the microphone, which drives me nuts, but we'll get through it. We'll make it happen. So it was 73 years, is that right? 73 years, the end of World War II in Europe. Alfred Jodl, who was the, I believe he was the chief of staff, the German chief of staff, head of the OKW, was the person who was sent to sign the unconditional documents. You could tell he didn't want to. This whole surrender of Nazi Germany was a very uncomfortable thing. It had to happen. I mean, there's no two ways about that. It had to happen, because if it hadn't happened, then obviously, A, the war would still go on, but B, there would always be this myth that we weren't beaten, that we weren't forced to surrender. And it had to be a German. It had to be a Nazi, Jodl, that signed it, because it had to be the Nazi. There was no, Hitler had killed himself, and you couldn't have Dönitz sign it, because Dönitz, despite the fact that he was now Führer, and despite the fact that he was a party member, he was not really seen as Nazi leadership. He was Navy. He was submarines. He wasn't really, you know, in the end, he was the one that got picked because he was the one that wasn't, you know, rat-finking out on Hitler like the rest of them were. So it had to be a Nazi. It had to be a high enough ranking Nazi that pretty much everybody knew who it was. And so pretty much the only guy left was Jodl. And so he goes and signs the unconditional surrender document. It, of course, doesn't go into effect until tomorrow, which will officially be VE Day. But Nazi Germany has been eliminated. It has been destroyed. It has been crushed. It has been defeated. It has unconditionally surrendered. That is to say, there's no, hey, Adolf's going to stay in charge. Well, he's dead. Carl's going to stay in charge. There's no, you know, we're going to maintain this area. None of that. You've lost. You will lay down your arms and you will surrender. I don't know. And of course, this will be followed up in August by VEJ Day when we have the Japanese surrender in August coming up in the same year. I don't know that we'll ever have another day like that again. I know that at the end of the first Gulf War, and kind of coinciding with the end of the Cold War, officially, we kind of had that. I mean, the troops came back from Kuwait, and we had a big parade. I know in Norfolk we had a huge deal. We had almost a, I call it the Vietnam reaction, the Vietnam expulsion is what it was. This idea that we had treated the troops who came back from Vietnam so badly that we kind of went overboard to make up for it in 91. And if you were a veteran or in the military at that point, I mean, you literally couldn't go anywhere without somebody pounding you on the back and saying great job and all this other stuff. It was, I still, even as a veteran today, I find that uncomfortable. I really do. I didn't join the military to have people come up to me on the street and say thank you all the time. I don't wear my hat because I want people to acknowledge what I did. That's not why I do it. I'm enormously proud of what I did. I'm enormously proud of what my grandfather did and what my great uncles did and my ancestors in the past in the military did. I'm very, very, very proud of it. But I will acknowledge that there is a certain amount of discomfort with people who come up and say, thank you for your service. I don't object to it. I would never say to somebody, hey, don't tell me that. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I buried enough of my friends and shipmates during my time. And I know that World War II vets left a lot of people behind and Vietnam vets left a lot of people behind and Korea people. There's always a little bit of, I guess the term is survivor's guilt. You always have that feeling of, why am I here and Chris isn't? You know, I mean, to me, when somebody says thank you to me, I, in my head, am passing that on to Chris, my good friend Chris, who died in a training accident on Valentine's Day while his wife was packing his car with balloons and his three kids were excited to celebrate that. And I, you know, to this day, you know, I mean, I recognize the fact that I believe in an all-controlling deity who has set every man's steps and their time is decreed and all that. And I get all that. But still, you kind of wonder sometimes. You kind of go, why him and not me? We've been, as part of the reunion process, my ship is having a reunion next month. And as part of that process, we've been setting up the memorial pages to those that won't be coming to the memorial because they're no longer with us. And it's, you look at some of them, you get some of them I'm older than, some of them I'm younger than. And, you know, why did this guy get leukemia? Why did that guy not get leukemia? There's a certain amount of discomfort with that. And I think, I can't speak for every veteran. I can only speak for myself. That's what goes through my head when I get that unsolicited, hey, thank you for your service. I don't want to stop wearing my dolphins because I'm proud of them. I don't want to stop wearing those things that indicate to people that I'm a veteran because they're something that I'm very proud of and they connect me to people that I want to connect with. That's why I wear them, to connect with those people. But at the same time, it comes with that. So anyway, all that to say that we kind of went overboard in 91 with the welcome back. But at the end of World War II, there was a feeling in this country unlike there's ever really been since. I mean, we've never decisively won a conflict in such a way that mandated such an event. The president wants to have a parade. Why? We haven't done anything to merit such a parade. And again, as I've said on numerous occasions, if you want to say thank you to the troops, that's great. Give them a weekend off. Stop fucking with their pay. Stop doing things that say we only appreciate you in name only. We're stretched so thin. Stop sending us to you know, we don't need to be in 54 freaking African countries. We don't need to be in every place around the world. And I'm not the libertarian isolationist either. I think there are places we do need to be for reasons that should be obvious, but aren't always. But we're sending people, we're stretching people, and you know, the only way we can say we appreciate you is to throw a parade that they have to work for. Does anybody else understand that? Do you get that this parade is work for the military? And for what? We did not win World War II here. We didn't. I mean, if we had done it like the Russians do on VE Day, their version of VE Day, they have a parade of the veterans to say thank you. Maybe, but we're never going to have that feeling again. I that's my fear. How will we ever win a war? How will we ever know we win a war now? These wars have become without end. We no longer have Congress. We no longer have a president going to Congress to pitch, to say why we need to go to war. We no longer have congressional debates to say, well, this is what the president has said. This is what we need to do. This is why we need to do it. This is the proper thing. This is the will of the American people expressed through its representatives in Congress and its elected president. And the American people are willing to go to war for this reason. And then we go and win the war. And then we bury our honored dead. And we honor those who fought the war. And we come home. We're never going to have that again because of the way we've allowed the political branch to control this. You know, Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex. It's really not the military-industrial complex. It's the political-industrial complex. The politicians are driven by the money that comes from the arms-producing industrialist section. Sure, the military loves its toys. I'm not going to take that away from you. You're not going to get any argument from me about that. I love military toys. But I also know that we, you know, 35 years ago when I was doing it, we had things we didn't really need. They were cool. They were fun. We didn't really need them. And we had way more of it in some cases than we did need. And things that we didn't really need, we didn't have enough of. Because some congressman somewhere got a campaign donation to get us this thing over there. And the other side of that, I think that's where Eisenhower went wrong. It wasn't the military. It was the political side of this. And here we are now today with a political system that no longer requires, air quote, a declaration of war to send American firearms, American fire troops, firepower to wherever it wants to go for reasons that may or may not be valid. And so how will we ever know if we do win a war? How will we ever know? The people that we're fighting against are never going to surrender. They're never going to send Yodel out there. There's never going to be a Mufti. There's never going to be an imam. There's never going to be a mullah that'll come out and sign an unconditional surrender. It's not going to happen. So how will we know when we do win, like we did May 7th, 1945? What news report will there be? Yay, the war's over? Hooray! Or will we have president after president saying, mission accomplished, combat operations have ended, we're pulling out, and then what? I just wonder sometimes. We sent those guys, we sent those boys, and they were boys, to Europe in World War II. I didn't discover anything about my Uncle Mick until a couple years ago. Not my Uncle Mick, my Uncle Bill. My Uncle Mick I knew about. My Uncle Mick was a sailor. He was a boiler technician on destroyers in the Second World War. And I wish I'd have known him better. I wish I'd have met my Uncle Bill. My Uncle Bill made all four combat jumps in the European theater during World War II. Market Garden, Normandy, Sicily, and Africa. He made all four of the major combat jumps, and probably a few of the smaller ones, too. He was known as Wild Bill. He had a thing about charging into places where wise men would fear to tread, but he survived it all. I don't know how. I'd love to sit down with him and Mick, my Uncle Mick, and just talk about, did you feel a sense of accomplishment? When we won the Gulf War, when we won the Cold War, we felt a sense of accomplishment. We have achieved what we set out to achieve, but I don't know that we ever really thought through the next move of that. I don't really, you know, it's like winning the Super Bowl. Hooray, we won the Super Bowl. Oh, now we got to draft again, and we got to draft last, and then we got to play the hardest schedule in the NFL. We got to do it all again. In some ways, winning World War II was kind of the same thing. I mean, okay, we won the war. Hooray, we've destroyed Nazism and imperialism. But now what? What ism replaced it now? Communism, as it turned out. And when we destroyed communism, what ism replaced that? As it turns out, Islamism. And on and on and on. And I just don't know that we're ever going to have that sense of victory again. I don't know that we're ever going to have that because of the way we do things. I don't know that we're ever going to be able to because we just don't consider it in those terms anymore. And that concerns me. Because again, we're sending our boys, and now our girls, to fight in places that don't necessarily need to be fought over, in ways that don't necessarily need to be fought for. I'm not anti-war. I've said this a million times. I'm not. If we need to go fight, let's go fight. But let's go fight like we want to win and get the hell out. Stop pussyfooting around. We need to have a debate in Congress. We need to have a presentation by the president to the Congress of the United States on national television, radio, whatever. Explain to me why we need to do this so that I can listen to you call my representative and say, this is what I think you should do. Let my representatives debate it, both in the House and in the Senate. Let them pass a declaration of war or not. And if they decide not to, well, then I guess we don't really need to go. Get rid of the War Powers Act. Get rid of the authorization for use of military force. Get rid of those things. Because they have allowed the political industrial complex to put us in wars that never end, debt that we can never get out of, all for the benefit of a few people who don't want to follow the rules. Which is exactly what Madison warned us about in Federalist 57. It's exactly what he said. Don't do that. And as soon as you do, you will begin to lose your liberties. And I don't think you'd find very many people that would argue that we haven't begun. Are we as free as we were in 1945? Do we have the liberties today that we had in 1945? I would argue that we don't. Government continues to expand its power. It continues to use its force to get its way. It continues to train its people to abuse citizens and then make excuses later on for why they've done it that way, rather than simply acknowledging that its purpose is to serve. And to uphold and defend the Constitution. I don't know. I don't know that anybody was thinking that on May 7th, the evening of May 7th, 1945. I know what they were thinking, which was that here's this Nazi, Alfred Jodl, sitting in front of us, stiff-backed and dour as he always was, Prussian as he always was, and he is signing a document that says, we have lost, we are defeated, and we surrender unconditionally. And nobody from that point forward could argue that Nazism had been stabbed in the back. Nobody could argue that Germany had been betrayed by the Jews. Nobody could. None of those arguments would hold water now. Because you got a Nazi signing that paper saying, the biggest Nazi of all is gone. And I'm one of the biggest ones left, and we give up. And give up They did. And a few months later, the imperialist Japanese would follow in the same foot. Hawaii. Let's go to Hawaii real quick. Volcanoes are cool, man. I don't care what anybody says. I keep watching the news of Hawaii. Is anybody else watching this? I don't know why I'm so fast. I do know in a bit of a way because Ben is fascinated by it. Ben loves volcanoes. He loves the power of nature and the idea that nature can kill you if you're not careful. It will try to kill you. It will destroy you if you let it. And I think I think all kids are kind of fascinated by that. Some years ago, Dave Barry wrote about dinosaurs, and he was writing about the fact that the reason kids love dinosaurs is because dinosaurs are undefeatable. They're unbeatable. They're more powerful than parents, and they are big and strong, and they can do whatever they want, and they can stomp wherever they want to go. And it's the same thing with volcanoes, I think. Hawaii is a giant volcano. I don't know if you knew that or not. The entire island chain are the remnants. Hawaii is the active one. But if you follow the geology off the southeast coast of the big island of Hawaii is another island coming up. It's another volcano that's coming up. It's a super volcano. And over the course of time, it has laid out these islands in this arcing pattern as it moves to the south-southeast. And eventually, the islands will wear away and sink and become atolls. But for now, I mean, it's not going to happen in your lifetime, so you don't need to worry about it. It'll just go over the course of millions of years, or if you're one of those people, 6,000 years. But you're wrong. And there's a new island coming up. They have a webcam on it, I believe. And eventually that island's going to poke up, and that may happen in our lifetime, depending on how much this thing. But it's a super volcano, just like Yellowstone. It's a super volcano, just like Yellowstone is, which has, of course, moved across the North American plate. And someday may erupt in Yellowstone. Who knows? What are we, like, 250,000 years after, past the average eruption date for that one? Who knows? Yeah, but point being that Hawaii is a giant volcano chain. I mean, that's what it is. Some of them are dormant and some of them are extinct. But on Hawaii, the big island, of course, it's a giant volcano. Kilauea, it's the biggest volcano in the world. It's taller than Mount Everest if you go all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. It's all those things. So I'm having a little bit of trouble with it. And I feel guilty about it. I really do. I feel guilty because I watch the news out of there, and these poor people are crying, and they're losing everything that they have. And there's a great video of a Ford Mustang. Somebody left a Ford Mustang on the road, and the lava comes down, and it's time lapse, so it doesn't really happen, like that quick. But the lava comes down, and nobody bothers to move the car, and the lava just eats the car. It's pretty cool. Lava porn, I guess, is one way to look at it. But I guess I feel kind of guilty because I'm watching these photographs, these interviews with these people that are crying because they've lost everything. And I'm like, dude, you live on the side of a volcano, an active volcano. This isn't one that you didn't know was there. This isn't one that you didn't know was going to erupt. This isn't one that you thought, it's like, Rainier's been dormant for what, 250 years. St. Helens was getting ready to go. It's not like people go, oh my God, we better get out of here. This is a volcano that's been continuously erupting since what, 91, 90, somewhere in there. And I know a little bit about the real estate market in Hawaii, and I know that it's crazy. So they're building everywhere they can. And my brain is screaming, you're living on a volcano. What did you think was going to happen? In what world did you say to yourself, oh, it'll be fine. It'll erupt, but it won't get us. I mean, I hurt for them. I do. I get the feeling. You lose everything, but at the same time, you built your home on a volcano. I don't feel any different about people that build houses on the beaches of the Gulf Coast or Florida. Florida's great. I get it. But you can build a hurricane-resistant home. You can build a home that will survive a hurricane. You can build buildings in California that will survive earthquakes. You can do it. You can engineer it. But there ain't nothing that can beat a volcano. Nothing can defeat a volcano. You can't build anything that will survive a volcano if it decides it's going to go your way. There's no way you can do it. Even if you build the building that could technically survive it, it's going to get buried. So what good is that? What's that? You can't win. But again, this is the free market capitalism that we live in. Well, it's beautiful land. It's a beautiful place, and people want to live there, and people are willing to pay what it costs to live there. And believe me, it's freaking expensive. And you run the risk of it being burned down by a volcano, crushed in a lava flow, and you're probably going to lose everything. And yeah, they're going to put out warnings saying there's noxious gas, the air is dangerous. You can't go anywhere near it because it's, you know, hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide. It's contributing to global warming. Except that they'll tell you it's not because they're still mankind. Who knows? I don't know. I'm somewhere between I'm sad for these people, but at the same time, it's like, that is so cool. Lava porn is cool. And it does make for fertile land. You're right, Jay. It does make, in fact, for very fertile land, you know, 20 years from now. In the meantime, these guys are just like, I don't get it. If you built a house on the side of Mount Shasta, right? Mount Shasta, one of the most beautiful places in the world. I love Mount Shasta. But I would never build a house there because I know what's going to happen sooner or later. It's going to happen. Same with Rainier. It's going to happen. Mount Rainier, the most dangerous mountain in America. Yet people are building right up to the slopes going, we don't care. Not going to happen in my lifetime. Are you sure? In Hawaii, you should be, because Hawaii is a, you know, chain volcano. It's definitely going to happen there. But out here, I don't know. See what happens. It's 9:30. I got to take a break, get my voice back in shape, get some coffee in me. 565-DAVE, 209-565-3283 is the text machine. Email us, dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. Stay with us, back in just a few moments.
So fast, Rocky. Did you remember to register with Selective Service within 30 days of your 18th birthday?
No.
Oh, too bad. Rocky Carr is stopped just short of the goal line. What do you make of that, Chet?
Well, Al, the law says that every man must register with Selective Service within 30 days of his 18th birthday. Now, Rocky could have registered online at www.sss.gov or at his local post office. Hey, it's the fundamentals, Al, and Rocky just didn't get it done.
You're right, Chet. That's got to be a big disappointment for a young man who had such a promising future. Let's see that again on instant replay.
Let's not, Al. It's pretty painful to watch.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that 4-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Only in the forest can you see this. And this. And this. But nothing beats the moment you see that.
Cool!
That's your child's eyes opening up to a world of possibilities.
I didn't know it could do that!
Because one trip to the forest can spark a world of difference.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, canoeing, fishing, or camping. Or create your own adventure with family and friends, and you might just see this. Your moment's out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Whitey from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
I don't know what that is. He said sarcastically. Welcome back. It's the Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You want to join me? Area code 209-565. Dave is the text machine. Email is Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. I'm trying to think if I'm anywhere else. Really, the best way to talk to me is on Facebook or Twitter. Really is becoming the best way because it's Facebook and its issues. You know how that goes. Welcome back. Somebody was telling me to drink some purple drink when I was pretending I don't know what that is. I feel like Bill Nye. Have you seen Bill Nye, the science guy on the... I've never watched the show, so Snoop Dogg has a new game show. And I guess marijuana references fly. Anyway, there's something about 420 and Bill Nye says April 20th. And then they cut back to Snoop and Snoop's making a real weird face at him. And they cut back to him and he says, oh, it's a marijuana reference. I get it now. That's how I feel about, you know, that little. Back during World War II, we actually trusted our government. The people of the United States actually trusted the government when they said things, they believed them. Even when they knew that it was a lie, even then they knew that it was a lie because they officially the government had to say something that the enemy would take as gospel truth. But we trusted the government. Our media trusted the government. Our media participated in security cover-ups. I guess cover-ups is the wrong word. Maintaining a cover security. We trusted the government. And then that started to fade away. By the time the end of the Vietnam War, we didn't trust our government at all. And nowadays, I swear to God, I bet half of the internet, if I'm just, you know, spitballing here, but I bet half of the internet is little more than the government is lying to you from whichever perspective you want to take it, from the far left to the alt, from the alt left to the alt right. Everybody believes that everything in the government is a lie. Government's not competent enough to lie that much. It just isn't. But much of the internet is all about how the government's lying to you. Everything is a conspiracy. Everything is a complicated, the earth is flat conspiracy as opposed to let's deal with reality. So a couple of years ago, when was this? I don't even remember how long ago. When was Jade Helm? Anybody remember that? Jade Helm was in 2015, the summer of 2015. And I remember the reactions. There was one particular website that I won't name, but it rhymes with DC Clothesline.
that had articles every day about how Jade Helm was an attempt to take over the government. They were, or take over the, just destroy conservatives, and Walmarts were going to become, abandoned Walmarts were going to become prison camps, and they were going to round up all the conservatives and take us all there. And so you remember all this? And so I would drive around the country back in those days, and we would see military convoys because we were next to Fort Lewis or something. And I would take pictures of it and put it on the website. Jade Helm, Jade Helm. It was the most inane thing I'd ever heard. I mean, it was just, the idea that people would believe this is remarkable to me. The idea that people would even listen to this and go, well, they must be serious. The government's coming. The army's going to come after me. I keep saying it, folks. It's not the army. When the day comes when the government decides to take away your liberties, it's not going to be the army knocking down your door. It's not even going to be the Marines. Certainly not going to be the Air Force. Definitely not the Navy. It's not going to be any of those armed forces. So why were you worried? People were. Oh my God, Jade Helm, it's Obama gonna, it's gonna lock up all the Christians. Cause you know he's a Muslim. Right? All that crap going on. Well, it turns out now, here we are 3 years later, after all that nonsense. Which, by the way, nobody who put out anything about they were guaranteeing this was going to happen, they had secret inside sources, none of those people have ever been held accountable for anything they had to say about this. Back during the hysteria, Greg Abbott became governor of Texas. Do you remember this? It's because Perry had gone out of office and Greg Abbott, the assistant governor, had become the governor of Texas. Speaking of assistant governors, ask governors, and completely shifting topics without a clutch here. Apparently the bees, Sacramento, Modesto, Fresno, have gotten a bonnet in there, or bee in their bonnet over Assistant Governor Newsom. You might want to check that out on any of their opinion pages. It's pretty funny. Anyway, back to this. So Greg Abbott became governor of Texas, and he ordered the Texas National Guard to, quote-unquote, monitor the United States military because he wasn't convinced. He was suspicious that Jade Helm was more than just a big old exercise. It was more than just a big old attempt to train American troops. This was aiming at Christians and Republicans and Texans, and we're not going to put up with that. We're going to defend ourselves. Right? So it turns out now that Michael Hayden, who was once upon a time the director of the CIA, he believes and has said and claims that Jade Helm 15 was a bunch of, you ready for it? You ready? Are you sitting down? Because you're gonna want to sit down for this one. He claims it was a bunch of Russian bots and Russian disinformation campaign. He claims that it was the Russians, not making this up now, he claims that it was the Russians influencing social media to scare conservatives and alt-right people so that they would, you know, panic and send out the National Guard to monitor the military. And ultimately, it was the success of that campaign, the success, the fact that they convinced basically half of the internet that Jade Helm was terrible, that it was government, and the only reason it didn't work now, the only reason it didn't work was because people like AJ and DC Clothesline and those folks got the word out, and so they couldn't actually pull it off. If they hadn't been there to do that, they would have been successful, see? It's part of the conspiracy theory. This time we were lucky. They only got to get lucky once. We got to get lucky. Anyway, point being, it was their success in doing that, that, according to Michael Hayden, that convinced the Russians that they could do it again. And so this, in his theory and his presentation, this is how the Russian influence came about in the 2016 election, was because of the success of Jade Helm, which, look, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I don't know. What I know is anybody that had a brain, anybody that had more of a brain than cabbage, knew that these people who were screaming about Jade Helm were idiots. And I'm sorry if you were one of them. I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but God damn it, you were being stupid. So at some point you got to go, well, if we're stupid enough to fall for that, what else are we stupid enough to fall for? And in the Russian world, because as Jay says in the chat room, it's always the Ruskies. Everything is, the Russians are behind everything. The Russians are behind everything. They're behind North Korea. They're behind North Vietnam. They're behind the Nicaraguans. They're behind the Cubans. Every blade of grass has a Russian behind it somewhere. The sense God gave a goose, right? If you had the brains of cabbage, you knew that none of this was true. It couldn't be true. It was impossible. Yet people bought into it. People believed it. And now the CIA is claiming that this is what led to the election of Trump. Tumbleweeds. Yeah, perfect. Tumbleweeds. Well done. Way to be a consistent listener there, Buster. Yes. But we used to trust the government. We used to believe what the government says. Now it's like we're trying to find reasons not to believe it. And sometimes it seems like the government's going out of its way to give us reasons not to trust it. That's the part that really bugs me. Incompetent government doesn't really offend me at all. It really doesn't. Incompetent government kind of says, stuff happens. I can deal with that. I can accept that. That doesn't really offend me per se, because again, it's government is of, by, and for the people, and people are imperfect, so I can deal with that. What I question sometimes, and look, I know government sometimes has to go into nefarious activities. I know that sometimes they have to do that, but as a general rule of thumb, if it's something that really needs to be kept secret, they will keep it secret. If it's something that doesn't really need to be kept secret, it'll get out because it's impossible not to. So when people start screaming about something like Jade Helm, I get pissy. But I also know, I personally know government secrets that I know for a fact have not gotten out because we don't believe that they need to be out. So we don't. Don't talk about them. It's really that simple. I don't know really what else to say about it, but I do know that government gives us reasons not to trust it over and over again. I've said this a million times, and it is still a working hypothesis, I guess. I'm not even prepared to call it a theory yet. But every day, I see more and more evidence of it. And remember that the test of a theory is that it has to be predictive. It has to have predictive powers. In other words, you have to be able to take the theory, the hypothesis that builds into the theory, and say, this is what will happen if this is true. And my working hypothesis is that government uses law enforcement in ways that it was never intended to be used, and by doing so, intends to violate the rights of citizens. That's my working theory. I've said this a million times. When your Fourth Amendment rights are violated, when your property rights are violated, it's not the United States military doing that. 99.99999999999% of the time, it's your local law enforcement agency acting on the authority of whatever local government has authorized it, or state government, or even federal government has authorized it to do so, or told it to do so, or permitted it to do so. It's not the military. This is why militarization of the police is such a bad idea. Because, again, in the concept that it's the LEOs, the law enforcement organizations, that are problematic when it comes to fundamental rights of the citizen, that's where the defense needs to happen. Now, again, don't put words in my mouth. I'm not saying go out and shoot cops. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we, the people, need to get control of our government, because the government is using these agencies to enforce its own regulations and its own ideas of what your rights should be. And sometimes, police officers themselves, law enforcement officers themselves, seem to forget, and I'll have this argument with anybody that wants to have it, seem to forget that their oath is to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, first and before anything else. The police officer's oath is not to serve and protect. Oh, it might be in there later on. But the first words out of your mouth are, I, fill in the blank, solemnly swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. Given that, what should be the first and foremost thought through any LE officer's mind when faced with a situation that might require policing? Am I doing this in a manner that maintains the constitutional rights to the degree possible of everyone involved? And I realize that there are exigent circumstances, and sometimes, you know, there are authorized circumstances under which the Fourth, Fifth Amendments don't apply. I get it. I understand that. Is a package of Mentos one of those? Guy goes into a store. It's a convenience store. Standing in line at the store. He buys a pack of Mentos. The Fresh Makers. $1.99. My son wants me to buy some so we can drop them in a Pepsi bottle. I don't really want to do that. But anyway, he wants me to do this. So the guy goes and buys a 49-year-old guy. He's going to the store to get some cash because he's going out partying. And his wife wants him to pick up some Mentos. Okay. So he buys the Mentos. I'm presuming that as part of this, he, you know, swipes the card and wants cash back, you know, $20, $30, whatever, on a pack of Mentos. And it happens. Once upon a time, many, many years ago, 40 years ago, I knew a gal that used to write checks at 7-Eleven for 65 cents to get a big gulp. You know, people do strange things with money. But at any rate, he buys the pack of Mentos. As the clerk is getting his change out of the drawer, he puts the Mentos in his pocket. Unbeknownst to him, the man standing behind him in line is an off-duty police officer. The police officer does what? What would you do if you were an off-duty police officer who swore to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States? And I guess you have to throw in that, you know, serve and protect item of this. You have to throw in this idea that I'm, you know, responsible for my community. What's your reaction to that? My voice is just about gone here. Sorry. This police officer, I presume trained in the workings of the Fourth Amendment, and I presume trained in procedure and functionality and all of those things, did what unfortunately more and more police officers are in the news for doing. And I know the argument is, but Dave, it's just one here and there. It's just a rare random case, but it's becoming more and more and more often. And this is what concerns me. How does any police officer who has gone to a police academy, who has been trained in his department's policies and procedures, who has raised his hand and said, I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, pull his gun on a guy for stealing a pack of Mentos, for him thinking that he stole a pack of Mentos? You get that? He didn't actually steal the package of Mentos, but the off-duty cop thought he did and pulled his gun on him and said, put those back. Where did we cross that line? Where did we get to the point where any police officer at any level thinks that that is worth a threat of violence? Where did that come from? Where is that in the Constitution? Where does it say in the Constitution of the United States that the government of the United States, because he's a police officer, he works for the government. He is the government's representative in this. He is speaking with the force, the power, the point of gun for the government. Where does it imply in any state constitution, any federal constitution, that the theft of a $2 item is worth threatening a man's life for? And I don't give a rat's ass what you say. You pull a gun on somebody, you are threatening their life. You are using the threat of force, period. Period. If you're not going to use the threat of force, why do you pull a gun? Why do you think you need to pull a gun? What is in your brain that says $2 is worth potentially shooting a man in the chest? When did $2 become worth the potential consequences? What if I miss and hit the clerk? Oh, that would never happen. I'm too close. Really? It's a pistol. Pistols aren't known because, you know, known for their wildly for their accuracy. What happens if the bullet goes through him and hits another customer? What happens if he's armed and he doesn't know that you're an off-duty cop? And he's trained in jiu-jitsu and you don't know that. And he, you know, you're close enough. Where did that become worth all of that risk? What law enforcement agency teaches its deputies, its law enforcement, its officers that, hey, you think that guy stole $2 Mentos? He didn't. He did not, and that's important. He did not steal it. Where did that become important enough? Where did an LEO become self-inflated enough to say, it's my duty to protect and serve by potentially killing a man over a pack of Mentos? And you wonder why we don't trust the government? You wonder why people are going, yeah, I don't really want to give up my guns. How would the police have ever have explained this? The officer, the man is obviously flustered. He's like, wait, what? And so he actually takes the Mentos out of his pocket. Think about that one for just a moment. He takes a long cylindrical object out of his pocket, puts it back, hands up, takes his change from the clerk and leaves. And then the cop says, did he pay for that? Well, yeah, he did. Didn't you see him pay for it? It was right in front of you in line. Mr. Observant Police Officer, didn't you see that? Well, no, I didn't. And now, let the excuse party begin. Well, Dave, he was just doing what he thought was right. Under what circumstances? Under what training program? Under what policy is that right? And now, you're going to see the people that will come out of the woodwork saying, oh, you got to support the blue. Call a cop when you need one. You'll call a cop when you need one. I get all that. You want to know why we don't trust government? That's why, right there. Because government has empowered people to believe that they can do this. And don't tell me it only happens once in a while. It happens every week. Whether you're talking about a deputy in Seattle who gets a 5-day suspension, or in California where a guy, you know, not only did he not get his Mentos, but now he's got to go, he gets threatened by a cop, and now he has to go home and explain to his wife why she didn't get her Mentos. And we're going to make excuses for this. We're going to make excuses for, he was just doing his job. No, his job is to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And nowhere in the Constitution of the United States does it say, in fact, it's very specifically, it says the opposite, no partisan shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. Due process means you investigate, you question, you ask. You don't whip out your gun and go, put those back. This is why we continue to have problems. And it's why we continue to not trust the government. It's why some of us continue to worry about militarization of the police, who continue to refer to me as a civilian, which just pisses me off. I am not a civilian. I am not. You are. And continues to cause the problems. Do you get what I'm saying here? My voice is gone and I'm... my. I'm losing my ability to speak. We're going to have to rein this in. And if the people of that locality, the people of that local government, allow this cop not to be terminated, because he should be fired, should never be allowed to carry a badge again. But if he is, well, he's not going to learn nothing. And just like the Nazis, if they hadn't been forced to surrender, they'll be back. They'll do it again. Just like the Germans did. They weren't forced to surrender during World War I. Oh, they were punished and all, but they were allowed to maintain their mythology, and they were back. This officer should be terminated, should be disciplined, and he should be sued. And he should never carry a gun again. I got to get running. My voice is gone. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. This is my show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. I hope I'll see you tomorrow. I don't know. We'll try. Stay tuned. This Week in U.S. Politics is next right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Plausibly Live is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. To contact Dave directly, call or text area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. For more information or to hear past shows, go to www.plausiblylive.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.